Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff, one of your three co-hosts. Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer are the other two. They always join me here for the intro. Hey guys.
Co-host number two checking in.
They're always showing up.
who's on the show this week?
This week I talked to Barrett Swanson. He is a journalist. He's an essayist. His work has appeared in a lot of different magazines, Harper's, The Believer, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine. And he has a collection of work out called Lost in Summerland, which includes a great piece that he wrote for the Atavist magazine a couple years ago by the same name. And one of the things I love about his work is he does these sort of immersive reporting pieces. He did one recently about a TikTok collab house for Harper's. He did one about a kind of men's self-improvement weekend a couple years ago. And he did one about a home for psychics and mediums called Lilydale. And I just really like talking to him about the lens that he uses to approach that kind of reporting, how much he puts himself into it, his own personal background. And we talked about all of that and kind of how he gets this work done.
How much did you guys talk about going on male self-improvement weekends?
I mean, a good bit. I'm very curious about these. People pay. They pay to go. Instead of going to therapy, they go on these weekends where they do like anger howls in the woods.
You know, we've been doing this show for like 9 years, you guys. Maybe it's time for us to go on a male self-improvement weekend.
There's an easier way to improve yourself with an email newsletter from MailChimp. They make it so easy to do it. You can do it from home. And you'll be like looking back in a few years, quite happy with your decision. So thanks to MailChimp.
Now here's Evan with Barrett Swanson.
Barrett, welcome to the Longform Podcast. It's good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with this TikTok story because it so infected my brain when I read it that I feel the need to talk about it. So you spent, I think, 5 days in a house.
Yeah, I spent a long weekend in Los Angeles and toggled between three what are called collab houses, which are tenanted by social media influencers of various levels. So this particular group, Clubhouse, that I spent time with, they had three separate houses and they conceptualized it as a kind of university structure, at which I took great umbrage being a university professor, right? But they had Clubhouse BH, which was for their quote unquote more seasoned influencers. So that was like a kind of grad school. And then Clubhouse FDB, where I spent the majority of my time, was kind of their undergrad setup. And then they had Not a Content House, which is since rebranded to, I think, Just a House or something like that. But that was geared toward their kind of younger demographic. And they've since expanded and come up with different houses. So they have kind of a whole bouquet of options. They're really kind of cornering the market here.
And you described a little in the piece itself, sort of like how it came about that you got there, but maybe describe that, because that's always one of the questions in these types of stories. I mean, you're a magazine writer. Your book wasn't out at the time, but you're also a professor. Like, you are a presence that can be found online. And the idea that whoever is doing publicity for this would sort of let you come do this immersive reporting there can be surprising. So how did it start?
Yeah, I mean, there was in March of 2020, there was like a Cambrian explosion of these houses. The New York Times, I mean, you probably saw some of these pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It seemed like sure. New York Times was running a kind of deluge of these pieces about the Collab House. And I kind of offhandedly joked to my editor at Harper's, like, hey, maybe I should go check out one of these places. And she said, yes, absolutely. And so I started making inquiries to these various houses. And I think I kind of talked with a number of publicists, some of whom were incredibly wary of a writer coming in, or were hoping that I would do a kind of profile on one of their influencers. And Clubhouse reached out and they said, sure, why don't you come out?
Did they inquire? Did they do the sort of typical, you know, is this a hit piece? What's your angle?
There was some of that. I sent them a link to Harper's and I think a link to my website. And then during the actual reporting, some of the talent managers kept asking, is like, this going to be a hit piece? Is this going to be a hit piece? And I don't know. I mean, my stuff is, it ends up being a way for me to think about how this is implicating me, right? Like, mm-hmm. how I'm especially wary of pieces that end up being some sort of voguish condemnation of something or phenomena that just seems ripe for a takedown or something. I just don't find it particularly compelling as a writer. I won't take those pieces unless I feel like whatever I'm looking at is somehow implicating me or my habits of mind or some sort of cultural logic that seems bound up with my daily life in some way.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel that before you arrived?
Yeah, no, it did not. I didn't really know. Usually there's a lot of prefatory research that kind of calibrates my thinking in going into a piece. For me, that's a way to sort of create some sort of interpretive lens so that when I go on the reporting trip, I know what I'm looking for. But when you're talking about a collab mansion and the sort of infant-like a freshness of this phenomena, there wasn't a lot for me to take in. And so I was reading around these issues, but I didn't have a sense of what I was going to be looking for. And then when I went there, you know, you're spending time with these incredibly genial and kind-hearted kids, and they're in a system that is rewarding them for the most inane and kind of ridiculous behavior, right? They're being paid gobs of money for this. And so while I was there, I was just kind of looking, I found myself looking around and being like, well, none of this is especially interesting, right? Like, if I'm just dramatizing what it is I'm seeing, a lot of what it is college-aged guys horsing around. But the larger mechanism, this kind of scaffolding around them that's encouraging them to do this. And then once I started talking to them about their interaction with TikTok and the ways in which they're beholden to the algorithm, or they think about their followings and think about crafting this online persona, and some of the ways in which they were characterizing the psychic desperation, even if it was only in oblique ways, it just felt so kindred to the things I was hearing in my classrooms from students and to some of the things that I think about in relation to my own professional success, the ways in which you sort of ingratiate yourself or you present yourself as a brand. And suddenly, having spent enough hours just listening to them talk about this stuff, you start to put it together and say, gosh, this isn't, like, it would be really easy just to sneer at these kids, but they're actually just this sort of well-complected embodiment of these calisthenics that we all perform on social media, or in light of social media, I should say.
And when you're in the environment, and you write a little bit about your role, and they do make a TikTok with you in it.
Yeah.
It sounds like it did quite well. I meant to look it up and see if I could look at it. But do you try to always be a certain type of person in that environment? Like, I'm going to be a little standoffish and not a joiner, or I am going to be a joiner and I'm going to participate in anything that they'll let me participate in.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I started out as a fiction writer, and so I'm trained as a fiction writer and got into magazine work kind of later in my 20s. And so I think that I'm halfway proficient at kind of figuring out the emotional or psychic ambience of a place and kind of making myself available for that. If there's a thing that I sort of pride myself on as a writer, it's that kind of going into a place and just being able to kind of feel the contours, this sort of emotional contours of a situation, and then making myself available for that. Really kind of, and two, I feel like that sort of prefatory research, I don't know if you find this as well, the prefatory research kind of clears the emotional space for me to just be present when I go on the actual reporting, because I already know, I kind of have a sense, I guess, of the intellectual parameters of the piece, so that when I go, I can just say, okay, these are people in this bewildering and absurd situation. How can I be available to really hear them or hear what's here? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, thinking about the various pieces, like, yeah, you're always kind of modulating your repertorial persona based upon the situation. Like, for instance, when I hung out with anti-war veterans who started this organic farm and protest community in central Wisconsin. And coming into that, I was a civilian in their eyes. Like, I hadn't served. And
right.
Apart from whatever status I held as the writer, I was also a civilian. And so had to kind of earn their trust. And so I think, yeah, you're constantly thinking about what sort of debts do you owe the subject, I guess? Like, what sort of intellectual and emotional debts do you owe them? And how can you make yourself available to them in a way that serves the piece.
And it also brings to mind the piece you did about the sort of like men's group.
Yeah.
You know, that goes into the woods and the lodge and engages in a lot of self-discovery and emotional exploration through different exercises. And a sort of similar question arises, which is, when you're going into that, obviously you come with a certain skepticism and a certain cynicism, perhaps, about what they're doing. And how much do you kind of play along / open yourself up to what's actually going on?
Yeah, yeah. So that was another piece. That was the first piece I did for Harper's, in which I was dispatched to Everyman is the name of the company. And it was one of many, like a spate of basically like corporate wellness retreat weekends that were putatively tonics for toxic masculinity, or ways for men to think about their masculinity and kind of reckon with stressors in their life, etc. And so, yeah, going into that, sure. I mean, there was a large dose of skepticism. And what, going into it, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how much I would be like emotionally conscripted into the weekend itself. But then you start hearing the testimonies of these various men who were there, and you're hearing about childhood trauma. You're hearing about suicide. You're hearing about divorce and financial turmoil. And it becomes hard not to become tenderized in some sense to these people and to their situations. Mm-hmm. And because I was doing a lot of these large groups and small groups and these kind of sometimes very harebrained exercises, like the anger ceremony in the woods, you're being exposed to basically the rawest emotional experiences that some of these men have ever been part of. And so how, as the writer, are you balancing both the impulse to dramatize those events vividly and accurately, but at the same time being emotionally fair to them, right? To mm-hmm. and what I basically, the place where I came in that piece was that the utter absence of any kind of intellectual framework for these men to think about their masculinity, because in essence the retreat weekend was kind of like a festival of catharsis. There was just, you know, a lot of opportunities to like vent and emote, but not a lot of discussion about, well, what are the sort of cultural narratives that are allowing you to feel the way that you do, or conscripting you into a certain way of thinking or certain behaviors, right? Well, how might we interrogate those things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Absent anything of that, I began to really feel for a lot of these men, because they were coming to a place clearly out of some sort of, they'd hit some emotional terminus in their life. They needed a place like this, mm-hmm. or they needed a place to sort of reckon with these things. And from my vantage, the support that was offered was not, provided no lasting latticework for them to understand their experiences. So it was just, it's tricky, right? Like I find myself in these places where the animating intellectual energy of the place warrants some sort of clarification, and the people inside of that are suffering, right? So it's, I'm always like finding myself in these kind of dual roles where it's like, I feel emotionally invested in the subject, and I'm seeing how the narrative that this place or this subculture in which with which they're interacting is actually perpetuating maybe some of that suffering, even unwittingly. And so I feel like part of what I get really excited about, or what I find to be a kind of charismatic or urgent situation, is those in which I'm kind of disentangling those two things and kind of holding them both up. And usually doing that involves implicating myself in some way.
I mean, it feels like that including yourself in the pieces kind of cuts against this other side of it, which seems inevitable to me. Like, I mean, you said, for instance, with the TikTok collab house, you didn't want to write, you know, a screed against these kids and what they're doing. It's more about what they're caught up in. But also, as with the men's group, as with the house, there's an absurdity to it that is funny, and that it can read as mockery just as a description.
Yeah.
Just the descriptions of it can read as mockery. And I think looking at sort of like the Twitter response to the story, like some people kind of take it that way. And when you're sitting down to write it, do you have in your mind at all what I don't know if those kids will read it, but whether they will read it that way? Like, I don't read it that way, actually. I don't read it as mockery. But I could see that they might think it was the quote unquote hit piece that they were afraid of.
My hope is that the opening of a piece is kind of this enticement, right? Like you want to kind of acknowledge to the reader, like, yes, I know. And I'm here in that same observation. I can see how this is a silly and absurd situation. But if the piece is working, at least for me, I find that there's a kind of emotional or thematic undertow where by the end of the piece, I hope anyway that that piece feels like I felt for these kids by the end of it. I wish only the best for them and saw them as being part of a system that, however financially remunerative, I worry about, you know, the psychic toll of that. So I kind of see the pieces that I do, and I'm thinking too of the piece I did about Lilydale, which is a psychic community. I'm sure we'll talk about that maybe. Mm-hmm. Where it's another kind of like zany subculture, right? And the impulse is to kind of satirize them or sort of present this caricature. But it's really a way, like the piece is always open in that kind of more skeptical headspace, because that's a faithful depiction of where I was at in doing the reporting. Like I started, going in the TikTok house, like going into these mansions, and it was like super West Egg. It's all nouveau rich like stuff. There's like statues of Hercules, and there's a 16-foot portrait of George Washington on the wall, and you're clutching your head. You're like, what, where am I? But by the end of it, that last scene in the piece, the dinner, I was just kind of looking around. I just felt really sad. I mean, for a number of different reasons, some of which I talk about in the piece, but I just felt sad. And I wanted to take that sadness seriously. Like, what were the various reasons why I was sad? And so, yeah, I guess that's a really puffy cheeked way of saying that the piece is meant to be read in whole, right? Like, by the time you get to the end of it, I'm really hoping it's clear that I was not mocking them, that I was trying to put myself up as much for the reader's scrutiny as anybody else in the piece. And that's, I find that I do that a lot. Like, if I'm going to present people in silly situations, and I kind of hasten to to make that clarification. Not silly people, but like people who are steeped in a weird environment. Like if I'm going to depict those things, I only feel comfortable doing so if I'm going to put myself up as a character as well, and put me on the same kind of playing field as the subject, so that I'm kind of triangulating reader, writer, and subject. Hopefully that's the end goal, is that we're all kind of like, that the camera's kind of panning around and seeing all of us. And at some point, I hope that the pieces implicate the reader. I don't know if I'm always successful, but that's like the attempt anyway.
Yeah, I feel that it did in this particular case.
Oh, good, good. That's gratifying to hear.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
This is a segue into perhaps talking about the 18-year-old you, and not to get too meta about it, but what happens if the current version of you shows up to do a piece on the 18-year-old you? What would they hone in on?
Oh my God.
Would it be football? I mean, you wrote about football.
I wrote about football.
Maybe it was football.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe in a way you have done it because you've written about that time in your life.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it would be football, and then like a budding interest. I entertained delusions of becoming a speechwriter. I thought I would, you know, like I would do the thing, like be like wearing the beaten leather jacket on the back of the campaign bus and like scribbling speeches for the candidate or whatever. Like that was my dream when I was 18, 19, 20 years old.
Well, where the political speechwriting, you have a piece about that where you sort of link that to a love of the TV show The West Wing. But is that where it actually derived from, or did it go in the other direction?
I think I got interested. I want to say it was like the Carrie Bush campaign. So whatever, like the 2004 campaign.
2004, yeah.
Yeah, I was at school, and like a lot of people, I think 18, 19 years old, got politicized and like got deeply into it. And I remember, you know, being home from school and like jogging around my neighborhood listening to like the audio versions of inaugural addresses. Like that's how seriously I got into it. And
wow.
Yeah, then yeah, started watching The West Wing. Oh God, I can't believe I'm talking about West Wing right now. it's like so that Sorkin-esque charisma. Yeah, like I got really into The West Wing, and then I interned in then Senator Obama's Senate office in Chicago, and then was interning on the campaign for a little while, and thought I was going to go to DC when he won in 2008, but got into an MFA program. And so then, rightly or wrongly, decided I was going to try writing.
Well, let's talk about that choice, because I mean, it's not just that you interned in his campaign, but you were the type of person, like, this is like, the story of the person who becomes a speechwriter. It's like you heard his speech.
Yeah.
You wrote a letter to the campaign.
To that Senate office. Yeah.
To the Senate office, right. And they said, I mean, this is his speech to the convention, his famous speech to the convention. And then, you know, they say, why don't you come intern? And I mean, that is the beginning of a story of like your political life.
You can imagine like the Aaron Sorkin, like triumphant trumpets blaring and the gauzy edges around the screen. I don't know. I think in some sense, writing was going to happen one way or another. And then I had a couple of professors, like I think a lot of people, I had a couple of professors in undergrad say, have you ever heard about this thing called an MFA program? And I applied and got into a couple places, and I kind of wanted to give myself a shot at writing fiction and writing stories. That was kind of the plan. I thought I was just going to be a fiction writer.
But was there, I mean, you write in these essays about, you know, a couple of like tragedies and near tragedies in your early life. And was a kind of like exploration of your life part of what was driving you to fiction, that you wanted to understand things about your own life that you thought you could explore?
I feel like you're going to have to bill me after this conversation, because we're going to, I mean, that's like a very astute, therapeutic reading of it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably right. I mean, I don't know that I did like an in-depth post facto on like what were the motivations for doing it. Was kind of a seat of the pants decision. Like you're 20, I think I was 22 or something at that point, and I got into an MFA and I was like, I could go through door one or door two. And I was like, well, why not go through door two? At that point, it just felt so, everything felt so provisional. It's like, if it doesn't work out, well, maybe then I can go to DC and get back in touch with people. But, you know, in college, right, my brother had a traumatic brain injury. He was assaulted outside of a bar, had 7 brain contusions. It was a real bleak scene. And then around that same time, a best friend from high school, his body was found in the Mississippi River, drowned after a night of drinking, with no explanation really of what happened. And around his death bloomed this whole assortment of weird theories, but the most predominant of them involved the smiley face killer theory, which was this idea that this roving gang of serial killers was moving around the Midwest and drowning young men and making it look like accidents related to binge drinking. There was these 2 retired FBI investigators found marked on rail cars, bridge abutments, near where the bodies were found, this graffiti of these smiling faces. And so they started putting together this theory, and it became the stuff of true crime discussion boards. And I got kind of enlisted into it during graduate school. And so, yeah, so I think that's probably right. Maybe the fiction thing was a way for me to make heads or tails of some of those traumas or like vicarious traumas. Like I think that that's, you know, like how I conceptualized it. I was like very proximate to these things. And so have been, trying to figure out what they mean for me and what it meant to bear witness to them in such an intimate way.
The smiley face killers thing, it just seems like such an early version of almost like a merging of what is everywhere now, which is both this sort of like online sleuthing, we're going to solve a murder, mixed with a kind of conspiracy theory that is perpetuated by, you know, sort of message board culture in which people are kind of encouraging each other to go deeper and deeper down into it.
Yeah.
And I wondered what you felt about the people who didn't know him, like the people who are just speculating, the people who are just out there. Maybe it's a little more of a game to them, or maybe it's not, but that aspect of it is almost more connected to being a reporter, like going and investigating something that's not, it's not your tragedy. It's not your situation.
Yeah.
And I wondered how that part of it had affected you.
Yeah, I mean, and too, there's a way in which sort of the essayistic impulse, the conspiratorial impulse, and the sort of literary critical impulse is this kind of interpretation of events, right? And you're kind of piecing together clues and trying to make heads or tails of this thing that's irresolvable, fundamentally irresolvable, whether it's the author's intentions or whether it's, you know, this your friend's tragic death or whether it's this sort of crime that's unsolved, the impulse is all the same. And so, yeah, it was weird because a lot of the theories on the discussion boards or within these communities that were looking at the smiley face killer theories, they were running along parallel lines of like things that you would hear in like a grad school seminar, right? Like that, like people were wondering whether it was related to, you know, some sort of blue collar workers going after these entitled college kids or whatever. Or so there's like this Marxist element. There was a feminist reading of the drownings. There was like a post 9/11 read of the drownings. And so it was like really weird to be in graduate school at that point. And at that point I was in a class on advanced semiotics for reasons that are still kind of unclear to me. And it was like the same discussions we were having in that class. It was like, I was seeing it play out on these conspiracy theories. It was just bizarre. But yeah, I mean, I think the sort of cognitive swerves can be similar sometimes. You're kind of piecing things together. And maybe whatever queasiness I feel about that, just like scenario, that might go some way toward explaining why I'm always like, okay, but like, how are you implicated, right? Because you want, you're like, well, why are you writing about this? You know, like, what is taking you here?
So let's talk a little bit about your fiction, because here you are writing nonfiction. I see in your bio that you've won a Pushcart Prize, which I understand is a prize for fiction. So it seems like that was going well.
Yeah.
So what changed?
I had some success with a story, and I found that after I had success with the story that won the Pushcart Prize, I just kept writing that same story. I kind of got locked into a shtick or a sort of dramatic calisthenic that I just found, like, I just was writing the same damn story over and over and over again. And my spouse, who's also a writer, she's like, you realize that this is like the kind of same emotional swerves as that other piece, right? And so I turned to nonfiction really out of a kind of just kind of feeling locked up in fiction. I had a novel. I won't even call it a novel. I had a pile of pages that were that concerned a cluster of people.
that's a novel.
Yeah. And it was really that it was the summer, and I was supposed to be working on that pile. And a friend of mine told me about this group of anti-war veterans that he'd been hanging out with as part of like a CSA. He was getting his produce from them. And he's like, someone should really go write a piece on that community. And at that point, I really didn't know what I was doing. I just reached out to the guy, Steve Atkinson is his name. And I said, I don't know whether you're taking, you know, these sorts of queries, but I just want to come out and maybe do a piece. Like, I'm thinking of a long piece about you. I'd read some stuff about him online and he seemed pretty interesting. And because I was like glitteringly ignorant about how to do this, I went there pretty much every day for 3 months. And
That's a lot of material. An unfathomable amount of material. God.
I think the first draft was like 30,000 words. It was like stupidly long. And my poor spouse, I was like, yeah, I think I finished the piece. And I hand her this 30,000 word thing. And she just like, you know, nodded soberly and immediately was like, you need to cut this in half. Yeah. But that experience really kind of taught me a couple of different things. The first of which is like I liked doing it. Like my natural tendency is just kind of stay at home and kind of close off. And these pieces end up kind of nudging me out into experiences that that are clarifying personally. Apart from whatever, you know, intellectual things unify them, I think there is some sort of like, there's a personal thing happening too.
And did you feel like you took naturally to like the interview process or the process of sort of hanging around and gathering material and you know, when you take notes and when you record and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I just decided I was going to hang out all the time. The first day I went out there, I think I spent like 3.5 hours out there. And so this guy, Steve Atkinson, he was a part of IVAW, which is Iraq Veterans Against the War. And he had done like, I think it was, he did hundreds of missions in the Green Zone in Sadr City. He was the lead driver for a convoy, had post-traumatic stress, and had started this organic farm and protest community in central Wisconsin. And we were out in the furrows that first day, and he's giving me the spiel. And I could kind of tell, like, even like not having any experience as a journalist at that point, I could just kind of like, you can kind of hear the burnished phrases. Like he's road testing sound bites, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I just was like kind of waiting him out. Like I just like waited him out for like 2 hours, and then he started saying things that were kind of eccentric or just kind of like offbeat, and I was like, that's funny. Or and it started to rain, and we just kind of sat down in the furrows together, and I was like helping him pull thistle, and he's like, you can come out for however long you want. So it kind of taught me, like, you just kind of have to sit there for a long time. And I've really, that lesson was indisputably crucial for me, just being willing to talk to someone, even if the first half hour, hour is unutterably boring or it doesn't seem pertinent. At some point, like, there is, at least it's been my experience, that these little things, the deeper things, take a while to get at, and they kind of burble to the surface in moments when you're not totally expecting it to happen. And I only do like one of these pieces a year, or maybe one or two of these pieces a year. And so for me, it's just like making myself available for that moment to occur.
And there's a certain like frustration for me when a person who's written like literary fiction just picks up nonfiction. It's like an NBA basketball player like coming to the Y and just being like, I'm playing this pickup game. And we're kind of like, no, we're fine. No, please don't. We all feel like we're pretty good at this. But one aspect that I'm very interested in, and I feel like to do this type of stuff, like that you would consider like experiential journalism, where you kind of go into an environment and then write about it, you kind of have to have the confidence that you're going to take someone in and that your thoughts and your impressions of it are going to be worthwhile for readers to consume. And I'm curious for you where you think that confidence derives from, if that makes sense.
Oh, God, what? No, like, the book is really born of a personal crisis that I had in my mid-20s when I was basically like near lethally depressed. And some of the book deals with suicidal ideation and a kind of a headspace where I was looking around trying to make heads or tails of like what should have meaning and what shouldn't have meaning. As a person, apart from my status as a writer, you know, there's a lot of different types of pieces in here. There's long form journalism, there's personal essays, there's like a piece of literary criticism. And so
yeah.
They all kind of defy their genre in some sense. They all end up kind of becoming about me in some sense and trying to reckon with those things. So when you say confidence, that is, you know, like I am cataleptically nervous when I go on these assignments. I am full of extreme self-doubt. You know, it's been this experience has been gratifying because it was like there have been some pretty dark headspaces like the last 6 or 7 years for me, and real points where I thought I wasn't gonna do this anymore, like I wasn't gonna write. And so I guess there's not a lot of confidence. It's like moments of extreme self-delusion where I like can get myself ramped up to sit down and write and think it's worthwhile, and then weeks and weeks and weeks of just rethinking everything and not knowing whether what I'm doing is worthwhile, like being real scared about whether any of this is just personal neuroses or if whether it's going to resonate with readers. Particularly, I mean, you know, the TikTok piece or the Lilydale piece, like the ends of those pieces, like I didn't know if people would resonate with those, some of those sadness, like the feeling of deprivation and sadness that I experience in thinking about, you know, crafting like a brand, or like feeling like personhood is being commodified, or that we're being asked to like think about ourselves as, you know, agents of neoliberalism or whatever. Or like in the Lilydale piece, and I talk about suicide, like, I mean, this is gonna sound like a platitude or something, but like, there's a way in which there's like a real personal urgency for some of these pieces. Like I needed to make heads or tails of either the narrative, the cultural narrative that I was exploring, or the personal event that took place, be it the drowning or my brother's injury or my own suicidal ideation, that kind of thing. Like that the writing ended up being a way of working through those things, or coming to some sort of conceptual understanding of them that made them endurable in the end. So all this to say is, like, I don't know, like, you have these moments where you're like, this is good, and then the next day you're like, wow, maybe you should be running a dog shelter or a custodian at a zoo or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I meant more was like, where do you find the moments when you sit down to actually write the piece? You have to sort of say, like, because I'll come home from a reporter trip and just be like, I've got nothing here worth telling anyone. Like, I'm just looking through the stuff and it'll just seem like it's a waste of time. And you have to find a place where you can say, okay, no, I have this and I have this and I can string this together. And it makes, maybe there's something here that's worth handing over to another person. And kind of like, how do you like locate those moments?
I think, I mean, it's kind of down the same path there. It's like, how am I and the reader somehow involved in this? Particularly because I go into places, as we were saying, like where you can easily parachute in and just kind of, you know, like a group of psychics and mediums in upstate New York living in a gated community doing astrology walks and seances. Like, your first impulse is like, okay, that sounds pretty kooky.
Well, give the background for that, because I don't think we have, you've referenced it, but I don't think you've explain sort of how you got there.
Yeah, so my brother had a traumatic brain injury when he was 22, and in the wake of that experience, he professed to have a number of psychic abilities. He claimed to have premonitions of things that ultimately panned out, or that he was being visited by spirits, hearing voices. And my own impulse and some of my family members' first impulse was that he was, you know, that this was some sort of ghastly consequence or after effect of the trauma to his brain. And he kept insisting on these things, and slowly other members of my family maybe started to buy into some of these things, and they started getting really bad. He started having, this was going on for maybe 10 or 15 years, and they were happening with such frequency that he started to get a little scared. And he had told me about this place called Lilydale, which was in upstate New York, not far from Buffalo. And it's home to 275 psychics and mediums who every summer kind of open their gates to like 22,000 tourists. And they do, it's like kind of like Epcot for spiritualism. There's astrology walks, there's seances, there's automatic drawing classes. And he asked if I wanted to go with him. And I, like, as a reporter, I was like, I was sort of vampirically interested. Like, my fangs had descended at that point, and I was like, yeah, let's go do that. And when we get there, we engaged in all manner of spiritualist stuff, right? Like, we did psychic readings, we did the automatic drawing class, we did all the things. And we were in a workshop on enhancing your mediumistic skills with this guy named Reverend Michael Shane, and it was like an 8-hour workshop. It was a long time. And during the course of that experience, or during the course of that workshop, all of the members of the class were sort of invited to come up and do this thing called billet readings, which is where you're blindfolded with three layers of things. Like, they put coins over your eyes, then duct tape, then a blindfold. And then everyone in the room writes out on note cards a number, and on the other side of the note card, there's like a question. And so everyone did this all the note cards are put in a basket, and then the person who's blindfolded kind of tries to read the cards. Everyone did this, no one's doing well. Andy does it, my brother, and he gets like 70% of them right. And kind of going into that experience, I was a cold-hearted materialist, like,
yeah.
And I, by the end of that trip, I suspended my disbelief in part because of that, but also in part because he had intuited things that were going on with me that I hadn't told anybody about wanting to kill myself. I mean, that's what it was about. And he somehow knew that.
Does he like being written about? Does he read what you've written about him?
He does. And he's funny. He like takes issue with word choice, and he'll try to like line at me. But no, I mean, he's like, it's hard to conjure Andy. He's like, I've been telling people he's like Vince Vaughn, who has psychic experiences, and works at a tech company. So he's like, imagine that sort of like amalgam of things. But he's like, he's always up for whatever. And to his credit, he was like, yeah, if you're going to write this piece, write it, like tell the truth. And when he said that to me, I knew that he meant like, you're going to have to talk about the darkest shit in your head. And so I did.
Okay. I want to ask you a couple other things. One is, I'm interested in you do fold into a lot of your work the aspect of it that you are a professor, and sort of like your students, your relationship with your students, it comes up. Like, it comes up in the TikTok piece, it comes up in other pieces where you sort of self-identify as a professor, and both these sort of like economic forces around that, like you describe being an adjunct professor as like the fry cook of academia, which I really, really liked. I'm gonna use that going forward. But how does, in a general sense, how does teaching writing, how does that interplay with your writing?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, that's, I think about this a lot. Like, on one level, there's like the practical thing, which is that because I teach full time, I don't have this sort of a financial imperative to do pieces that I don't want to do, right? Like, that was kind of the bargain I made with myself, like, as opposed to being like a full-time freelancer. Like, I really choose only like one or two pieces that I think that I desperately feel like I need to do. So there's that element of it. I mean, I have incredibly talented and brilliant students, and they are consistently forcing me to articulate things about the writing process that I would have otherwise left tacit or unspoken or not articulated to myself, to the point where I'm coming up with terminology that ends up being like a useful crutch for me as I'm thinking through a problem. It's like, oh, I'm like burying the backstory or something like that, you know? So just the emergency of having to explain a problem in a text ends up being really useful for me. And then too, there's all sorts of like the nuts and bolts thing. Like, you know, I teach first year composition alongside teaching creative writing classes or lit classes, and I put my students through a kind of grammar boot camp. So that ends up being really useful for me, just like, you know, working through teaching someone syntax and different sentence structures and that sort of thing. It seems like yawningly boring, but it ends up being really useful. And weirdly, the students are terribly gratified that someone walked them through these things. But then too, it's like, it's energizing to be around young people who are smart. And so, I mean, there's that too. It's just like, they're engaged and thoughtful. I mean, I'd consider that to be like the best job on the planet. Like, I sit around and I talk about stories with smart young people. That's my job. So I feel terribly lucky to be doing that. And I think there's a natural symbiosis too with just like writing this kind of work. It's like the problems that you encounter at the desk turn into lessons that you can kind of work through with your students.
But I have to say, it also, and maybe the TikTok piece is too much in my mind, but at least in that one, it also sounds a little grim. Like, they sound like they're struggling. I mean, everyone's struggling right now, but that there's a more systematic issue that is causing them to struggle more than students you've had in the past,
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I definitely noticed an uptick I mean, like a seismic uptick in depression and anxiety, and they're far more vocal about it too, which is good in some sense because they're aware of it, and lots of them are, you know, seeking therapeutic help for that. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and I talk about this in the piece, there's a way in which I think we as a culture are tutoring these young people to see themselves merely in professional terms, and the academy and higher education, as, you know, when I thought about becoming a professor, I mean, I see it as like one of the last spaces where we're really countenancing, like, what does it mean to be a person? Where should you find meaning in life? How should we think mindfully about these different social issues? How to interrogate a text? How to like have media literacy and know what's worthwhile and things like that? And there's been a broader change of mind about what the role of a university is, which is to prepare students for the job force. I mean, that was, you know, our governor here in Wisconsin tried to amend the UW mission statement from, you know, something like teaching our young people about improving the human condition or something, and he wanted to change it to meet the state's workforce needs. And when you ask young people to conceptualize themselves purely in terms of economic calculus, I think that that's soul withering in a way that's at least legible to me, because I see the anxiety and I see the confusion in my students. And yeah, I mean, I think that's what makes the job for me even more worthwhile, is having occupied some headspaces that were, you know, unutterably difficult. Whatever routes I found out of those headspaces, I feel like, you know, they're owing in some sense to my experience with writing and reading and books, is as sort of reading rainbow-ish as that sounds, right? Like, it's true. And so, yeah, I mean, it's been gratifying for that reason too.
Well, Barrett, thank you very much for coming on. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
This is a thrill for me, so I'm just terribly gratified to be here and to talk with you.
My pleasure. That's it for this week's Long Form Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And thanks to Barrett Swanson for that conversation. His book is called Lost in Summerland. It's out now. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer, to our editor this week, Seth Kelly, and to our intern, Julianne Sato Parker. Our sponsor, as always, is MailChimp, and we will see you next week.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.